Voices of the Temple, official podcast of the Temple of Witchcraft, exploring mystery and magic through love, will, and wisdom, hosted by Adam Sartwell.
Hey, listeners, to just get us into the space before I tell you who's on with me, take a deep breath. Draw your energy from the past and the future into the present moment as we call to the Great Spirit. We call to the two who move as one through the three rays of love, will, and wisdom. We call upon the goddess, the maiden, the mother, and the crone, past, present, and future, creator, sustainer, and destroyer, weaver of the web. We call upon the God, Lord of light and Lord of darkness, God of the green and the gold, God of the horn and the red, singer of the song. Be with us now and forever, so would it be. So, listeners, I am here with Michelle Belanger. I said that right, correct? Okay, awesome. I'm going to just dive into our questions because I have a lot of them this time. So, Michelle, how do you spiritually identify?
So that was an interesting journey for me because I was raised in a family where psychic abilities were accepted, but weren't necessarily seen as a spiritual path. And in college, I face planted into early Wiccans, and that didn't feel right either. And the word that I had identified with since I was really tiny was, at that time, a fairly radical magical identity to claim, which was the vampire.
Yeah.
And I still identify as a vampire. I'm a vampire who practices magic and witchcraft and is psychic, in addition to all the other things that I do. And obviously, in the same way that a witch is not a green-skinned, warty person with a pointy hat running around cursing the villagers, a vampire is also not what you would expect from folklore or fiction.
Or a witch is not in a big pink tutu and has a big wand either.
There's a little bit like the Barbie witch or the green witch, which one are you?
Exactly. I just saw Wicked, so it's clear in my mind. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal path and how it began and how you were initially drawn to it?
So I was metaphysically precocious, probably because I was born with a heart defect that meant that I was going to die by the time I was five if they couldn't surgically correct it. It was the early 70s, and the methods that they had at their disposal were fairly limited. So long and the short of it is I endured multiple experimental open heart surgeries before the age of five. And the final one that they were able to do cut it pretty close at 4.5. But all of that meant that, I was steeped in this experience of conversations about mortality and witnessing the mortality of others at a very early age. I didn't think of some of the more metaphysical experiences as unusual, didn't have a word for them, but like I could, there was a girl in the ward with me, one of the long stays, who had nightmares, and I could see her nightmares. I could feel what she was feeling, and I would regularly pull out my IVs and crawl into the bed with her and stroke her hair until she fell asleep. She was in there for observation to determine whether or not the problems she was having were were physical or psychological, because she had witnessed a truly terrible thing that I will spare everybody.
Yeah.
But suffice to say, she had reason to have nightmares. But like that was such a seamless part of my experience. And I think dreams and dream work and sort of traipsing through the psychic web work that connects people is another very significant part of how I operate. But of course, there were no guidebooks for that. And I lived in rural Ohio. I was raised by Well, a family that was nominally Irish Catholic, but mostly bitter ex-Catholic. My grandmother had had some bad experiences, had to like get a divorce, and pretty much just yeeted the church thereafter. She had some extraordinary beliefs and also was psychic herself. So, although I have a fraught relationship with her, she, of anyone, taught me at least about the psychic aspect, that it was real, that it was something to explore, that it was something to question. She encouraged me to keep journals, and her famous thing was anybody can be psychic after the fact. So if you have a feeling and you think it's telling you something, write it down and explore it and examine it. So I came from this milieu. And on top of all of that, you know, being chronically ill and just sort of trying to survive as a small person, as early as first grade, I was aware that I could take energy from other people to make myself feel better. No one had taught me to do it. I just knew how to do it. Along the lines of my grandmother teaching me to question stuff, I would experiment to see if that was actually something other people were feeling doing. I do not recommend the double blind method that I was using, because as a young person, I couldn't necessarily tell people. If I wanted to see that there was an actual reaction, I didn't tell them. That is a non-consensual sort of thing, which I teach strongly against now, especially because, you know, as a young person, not knowing what those limits or boundaries were, I saw what the impact was over time with people. But given what I had to deal with, like I didn't have a lot of other options to come to understand and accept that this was definitely a part of my reality and my past. Woven in through all of that is vivid past life memories, a profound awareness. My mom used me as her favorite party trick. She had me as a 20-year-old college student. She was a hippie, art student in Kent State. And she would be with her other artsy and theater friends. And, you know, usually she didn't have a babysitter, so I was often in tow. And I remember multiple times where like she'd be like, "Hey, tell us about that thing that you remembered." And I would just go rattling on about dying in the jungles of Vietnam or being somewhere where there was an island and then a really, really big wall of water and everything went away and a whole bunch of just things upon things upon things that were verifiable. The one that got me was the island where I'm walking on a beach. And suddenly the water goes away from the beach, and then everything goes to hell. There was a woman walking in front of me, and I would draw her dress and her earrings over and over and over again as a kid. And my mom pulled out her art history book, and I was drawing Minoan earrings, like down to the whorls and the things, as much as like a 3 or 4 year old could draw that sort of stuff, like but had the pattern down and like the tiny little like weird gold bead work that was very unique to that area and the time period when Thera exploded and pretty much washed away that civilization. So I just had all of these extraordinary experiences, and for me the sticking point was vampire seems like a stretch, though. So fast forward to like middle school and high school, where I started to read as voraciously as I could about, you know, anything that talked about vital energy, which led me to, you know, read the Bhagavad Gita and start to like really delve into other world traditions, where especially in Eastern traditions, the idea that there is a life force that connects people, that we can move and cultivate, that's kind of taken as a given. Over here in Western culture, where I'm, you know, growing up, that's a weird radical idea. And so I came to the point where I'm like, okay, well, clearly I'm not undead. I don't need to sleep in a coffin, although it's sort of fun for a gag. fun fact, we did Oliver as one of the theater things. I am a theater kid, and the superintendent of our schools happened to be the owner of the largest set of funeral homes in the area, so he donated a coffin, one of the floor coffins for the Undertaker scene of Oliver. And I quickly learned that napping in the green room invites all sort of chaos. Napping in the coffin means everybody leaves you alone.
It's true.
So I have in fact slept in a coffin, but mostly to keep the other theater kids from painting my face blue. But by that point, I was like, okay, I'm a vampire. I guess psychic vampire was finally the word that I found when I read Dion Fortune's Psychic Self-Defense. The problem I had with that, of course, is she's writing from the perspective of someone who is victimized by another person who was not in any way ethical. And so everything she presents is very much in a negative light. And I'm like, well, I can do all of these things that she's talking about. Like, this is exactly how I function, but I'm not an asshole. Like I'm not this person. And college is when I started to find other people who were similar to myself. I discovered the zine community, which strangely has come back into vogue, but in the late 80s and early 90s, it was like a big punk goth thing to do amateur publications and, share them through snail mail. I had a gothic literary magazine, Shadow Dance, and nominally, like vampires were absolutely like the main theme for that, but it was fiction and poetry, often bad poetry. Let's be honest, it was goth poetry in the 90s. But
I remember some of that.
behind the scenes, as somebody who practices anything, you can read someone who's writing fiction, and sometimes you get that little like, this sounds like someone who might actually be practicing, and they're using their fiction as a way of talking about it. So we had this extensive pen pal network behind the scenes of people who were having genuine experiences and trying to figure out what the heck to make of that, especially in light of the growing witchcraft and Wiccan movements at the time that were very aggressively white light because we're still operating in smack in the middle of the satanic panic. So anything even a little bit dark was just nobody wanted to deal with it. So I probably answered 15 questions there, but like that's sort of how I got there. Like swimming through a sea of experience, some remembered, some guidance from other people, a lot of struggling without answers, and finally deciding that I will write the book that I needed. That I should have had when I was, trying to find those answers as a kid.
And I know a lot of writers who do occult writing and things like that now. That's their story. It's like, I wanted something that I could go, yes, this is the book that, would have helped me at that point in my life, which I think is really beautiful. I'm also, resonate with the, reading something in a science fiction book or a fantasy book, where the person has just enough, like linked into that, I don't know what it is, to, sort of say, oh, this is something that, they practiced in this magic thing. And then I'm like, let me try that and see what happens. Which is where I came up with my, statement of like, there's nothing worse than a bored magician, or more dangerous than a bored magician.
Especially when you're like a young adult or a teen, because you have no boundaries, no limits whatsoever. You don't believe that you can't do it, so you try.
And then you find out sometimes that, like, oh, that's real.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Bafo is real at that age.
So my next question was, any early experiences or encounters that shaped your method of interacting with the unseen world? So you've kind of answered that a little bit, but do you feel like there's something more to add to that?
There were a couple of other events. One, I only understood like the profound import in retrospect. I mentioned that my mom, she often didn't have a babysitter, so I was just getting schlepped around with her among her college friends. And I remember frequent gatherings down in Kent, and they would all go off and like they'd be playing cards or like hanging out with one another. And her one friend would take me aside and we'd go off and quietly play. And she looked a little bit like Crystal Gale. Like she had like this long, straight black hair. And I remember her wearing like a fairly tight like turtleneck, like a almost like a cashmere turtleneck, like a soft gray, and sort of a round face, white woman, my mom's age. And it never occurred to me to be to ever question just hanging out with her, having her talk to me about things occasionally. Like she gave me seashells at one point. And this actually sort of beggars my belief in retrospect. She gave me these seashells. They were white pitted, like they looked like they had been in the elements for I don't know how long. I remember them specifically because my mom made a bit of a fuss over them because she wondered where I got them from, and I told them that her friend gave them to me. And she seemed flustered by that. I was too young to make any sense out of it. She let me keep them. I went home with them. These were physical objects. Years later, I was talking with my mom about her friends in college. I was verifying some of the memories that I had about talking about past lives. And I wanted to know the name of the person who had given me the shells, because I honestly I never got her name. And she's like, "Well, that the person you're describing is Michelle." And I'm like, "Okay, so," she's like, "the person I named you after." "Oh, okay." She's like, "But I named you after her because she got ovarian cancer, and I and her brother laid in bed with her. I was 5 months pregnant when we sang her across."
That's a potent experience.
So a lot of my personal practice is, if not vampire, I would say necromancer. Because so much of my existence is 1 foot here, 1 foot elsewhere. Perceptions here, perceptions elsewhere, not only the spirit realm, but the dream realm and all of those visionary spaces in between. And interacting with spirits sometimes so profoundly that I, seashells, she handed me physical seashells. How? How? I had them for years. I eventually put them in the crook of a tree in our front yard, and the tree grew around them. But it felt right.
That's amazing. That's such a cool story. I have certain resonances with this of like, asking my mom about, a certain dream that I had as a kid that I remember as a nightmare of like, but I didn't remember the story, So it's like I remembered the white man is what I called him, and he had big red eyes, and he was like following me around, and it was crazy, nightmarish kind of stuff. And asking her as an adult and being like, do you remember that? Do you remember me describing it? Blah, blah, blah. And she's like, "Oh yeah, that happened after your babysitter's husband died." And I was like, "Oh, okay." So, and my own mediumship, like the clearest I get is through dreams. So I'm like, "Okay, so he was trying to like message me, but he was totally freaking me out." So, in the dream world, he changed into this sort of nightmare creature. So I feel it. So coming forward from that, so you've had all these wonderful experiences, but are there any teachers or books that were helpful at that time or?
So I, in high school, in the band, actually, I think I was in 7th or 8th grade. I was, again, theater band kid. Someone in the band room had Buckland's Big Blue Book and Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft stuffed in with their, I think it was the trombone or the timpani. It was the really big shelves. And I am a little ashamed to say, because I had never seen books like that and had never gotten a chance to get my hands on books like that, I stole them and took them home. And felt a lot more resonance with Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft than I did with Buckland's. And no offense to Buckland at all. Actually, at the time, had no idea he was an Ohio resident. But that was some of the first like actual magic and witchcraft I'd gotten my hand on. Now, for psychic stuff, it's a different matter because the library, even my public school library, was rife with books from the Ryan Institute, different things about psychic development. And for me, those two things were parallel paths that converged in my experience. So finding that, I guess for me, the aha moment with the books was in my family, psychic experiences were things that happened to you, but you weren't probably ever going to understand them. And to study them too much sort of verged into occultism, which was bad. Finding that there were people who practiced witchcraft as a spiritual path as well as a religion brought me to a point where, like, this could also be just a part of my life. There were multiple other people, like, once I went to college, and really more peers than teachers. Just my favorite style of learning is salon style, like the old French salons, where you just get a group of people and you relax and you're talking about anything and everything under the sun and you share what your perspective is and, kindly and friendly debate stuff. And that was my greatest teacher at the time, was having those moments to have access to other people who'd had experiences, creating a safe space where we were comfortable sharing those experiences and really delving into our interpretations of what it meant.
I love that. That's awesome. So I have personally loved your writing on energy work in the Psychic Vampire Codex and in other books. And I was lucky enough to experience your group doing ritual with people and sh sharing a little bit about how you guys work together. But I want to, can you tell us about energy work in your rituals and how it's done?
So I founded a group called House Kepru. It wasn't called anything when I first put it together. It was just the group of people who resonated on the same energetic vibe. Like the way in which we experienced and interfaced with energy and magic was similar enough that, and different enough from other groups that like it bound us together. Where I started with is also inextricable from my degree in comparative religious studies. Because first and foremost, reading the works of like Victor Turner and such, realizing that ritual is a psychosocial event, that it's something that we need. Like whether or not you believe in anything beyond what people are doing, like humans need ritual. And in the late 80s and early 90s, I had a disdain for magic that had too many trappings. Like I saw way too many people just get like really hung up on this wand is my magic wand and the wand is where the power comes from, or this charm. And like it felt to me like they were missing the point, which was they were the magic, and any objects that they used, any actions that they did were ways of focusing and channeling that. So when I first set out to develop House Kepru's ritual system and magical system, I pared back everything I possibly could and asked the question, what is going on underneath the robes and the chanting and the candles or all of it? Like what does it feel like we are doing from inside? At which point I guess I mapped out how that energy work felt to build ritual space, to clear it out. And what I hit on with our system is we have three groups of people with different jobs, and those jobs are very specific to ritual. Warriors, priests, counselors, warriors as grounding and clearing and protective elements, counselors as connecting and cycling elements, and priests as focusing and directing. And it's not to say that anyone can't do all of those jobs. It's more that you allow for specialized focus so that if your job is warrior, that's all you have to worry about. And you know that you've got other people who can back you up. And then it becomes this group effort, a sort of connected song. So when we set space, the warriors go in first and they, dust the place off energetically and lay a foundation and then hold that sacred container. And then the counselors come in and then they raise new, fresh energy, drawing upon their connections, but also weaving connections between themselves and the people already standing there, so that we now have a container that is held with possibility. And then the priests come in, each of them carrying their vision of what temple space looks like. And although it can be misinterpreted that as a directing, focusing thing, that a priest is imposing their will and only their will, it's more about finding, to really do that work, you need to feel what does the collective need in that moment? How does it feel? And so you are really a mouthpiece for what that final shape looks like. And I think some of my most extraordinary experiences in ritual space is walking in completely silent with four or five, seven other people who are building this temple space. And we just nod our heads, close our eyes, and we feel it. And afterwards, we can all describe the exact same thing. And there's this moment where you can see each person's little piece, like somebody's got standing stones and another person is some weird deep underground thing and somebody else is remembering like classic Greco-Roman. And then it sort of like starts to connect in a way that now you have this amalgam that finds a harmony with all of the different voices and visions that build it up. And then from there, once the space is created, our ritual is almost always about expressing identity and putting change into the world, like allowing for raising energy with the intent of awakening others, whatever that is for them. Like pulling back some of the veils so that they are not mired in mundanity.
That's awesome. I thank you for sharing that. Because I'm having experienced it and, like taken on one of the roles to see, how it felt. Because I did, I think, connector, because that's more towards my natural state. And I remember like us all being connected and whatever, you guys coming in and doing your priesty part. And I remember I, saw like purple fabric wings coming out. And someone told me after that that was one of the images that you guys were working with. And I was like, oh, okay, great. glad I was there. It's interesting to experience. I know there is a lot of people who have pared back as well from their tools and their, whatever. And for myself, being a little bit fey, I'm mostly in communication with, what herb did I just put in there and what's its energy and, like that kind of thing. But I know that, magic can be done just through, energy and through will. So I just want to threw that out.
Yeah, I know. Like for me, it was important to pare it down to see like the why. Like I am at core actually quite skeptical about a lot of things, and like I ran into people in college who were just like, "Hold this crystal, it's powerful." Or like, "This one has got something evil in it." And I'm just like, "It's just a rock. I'm pretty sure the thing in it is you." But that's not to say that there isn't a place for tools also. And I think in the same way that Picasso had to learn standard painting and figure work before he did Picasso work that broke all those boundaries. I think it is essential to understand, like, what are the foundations, pull things down to the bare bone, understand those principles, and then make a conscious choice for what works for you. Whether it's, do plants speak to you? Do rocks speak to you? Do you really like music? Are you someone where, like, how you dress is an essential part of your ritual work? Then do that, but understand why.
And know that not everyone is going to resonate in the same way that you do. Like for me, and or have the same reference points. Like, we in the temple, we put on robes and we do all the things. I hate it because ritual garb to me is a sweater, because that's what I would do in Vermont. It's cold. You know, like you put on a sweater, you go outside, you do the magic, and you come back in. So, part of that, like clicks with me is like, oh, I'm putting on a sweater and that's magical. Which may be my obsession for sweaters.
But that's the beauty of it, though. Like, once you realize, like, it doesn't matter what the tool is, what matters is that is the tool for you.
So I had this sort of concept come to me, and I guess I've been thinking about it in the background or something. But this question isn't for the listeners. This is for me. So a concept that I've been thinking about that I wanted to talk to you about was that there are many levels of being, right? That we have physical and spiritual and emotional, mental, all of that stuff. That is sort of like a Russian doll of energy, or different levels, and maybe it's not as organized about that in the universe. Do you think that shifting energy or doing energy work is different at different levels of being?
I've definitely encountered groups working on different, levels, vibrations. We don't have good language for it, but the vibe is different. Almost like what they're drawing in and drawing down, what they're connected to is they're dialed into a different station on the grand radio. I know that's one of the things that, like, really stood out for me, because I made a point of participating in, or at least observing, the rituals and rites of a whole lot of different groups. And yeah, there's times where I'd be like, oh, this is not, like, I can see what they're doing, and I can see that they're doing something, and this is not what I do. Like, this tastes wrong. Like, this is just not my thing. I think an important thing, if you're experimenting like that, first is realizing just because it tastes wrong to you doesn't mean it's bad or that it's wrong. It just means it's not where you're at. And I think profoundly, more than anything, we need all of those perspectives all working, each of their paths, the thing that is most natural and needful to them. Not any one more right or wrong than the other, but all of them in tandem, creating a whole. This multifaceted jewel, so massive that none of us will ever be able to perceive, more than a piece of it, but together we are it.
Having experienced like different energy healers and watching them work, and because I'm somewhat psychic, as I would say, at least when it comes to energy, and seeing how like I'm very into Holly Zia Silva. That was one of part of my upbringing of or magical upbringing, I should say. And they're all about going to the causal plane and just erasing the pattern and then coming back with a new pattern. And I was like, that's a different type of energy work than, say, I'm physically, moving my hand to manipulate my aura to do healing work. Or does it make sense? Like, I just think it's so fascinating to me how through our expression of our magic, we come into an individuality that we then have to find ways to both manage and work with. Like, for myself, I'm very connected to nature, And so I have to, when I have too much people, I have to leave and go into nature and let all of the people stuff I've absorbed go and
Yeah.
reabsorb nature stuff. Which I know that sounds very weird, but
No, it doesn't. I'm married to basically a land spirit. My wife has to, like, I am, we're polyamorous, and her main other partner is the Southwestern desert. And that's just that. And like, she needs to go and recharge and just be immersed in that and be in conversation with that, usually by solo hiking. Which, for five, six little, like, non-binary but femme identified, like femme AFAB person, she's chased off mountain lions. I try not to worry because the land looks after her. But also, I think it's so important for people to find what their particular if path, vibe, like, where does the magic call you?
Hope you are enjoying this conversation with Michelle Boulanger, and we will continue this conversation in the second part. Thank you.
You've been listening to Voices of the Temple. The contents of this podcast are copyright 2010 of the Temple of Witchcraft. For more information, please visit templeofwitchcraft.org.